This is a Crestview Bible podcast. For more information, visit crestviewhutch.org.
You probably know that I love the show Seinfeld, and I guess that probably dates me now. I brought a Seinfeld joke up at a leadership meeting I had in the community on Thursday, made up of kind of younger people, and only one person had ever seen the show. I just like, what's going on? How old am I? How long have I been asleep? What's going on? And so the fact that I like Seinfeld may date me. It also may disturb some of you, and I get all that. But there's a famous episode called The Engagement, where George gets engaged to his girlfriend, Susan. And he comes to Jerry's apartment to announce the news, to find out that Jerry's current relationship isn't going so well. And here's how it shakes down. Jerry says, "Well, you know, we were having dinner the other night, and she's got the strangest habit. She eats her peas one at a time. You've never seen anything like it. It takes her an hour to finish them. I mean, we've eaten dinner at other times, and I've seen her eat corn niblets, but she scooped them." And George says, "She scooped her niblets?" And Jerry says, "Yes, and it was so vexing." And it's at this point that George reminds Jerry about a pact that they had allegedly made. So Jerry says, "What?" And George says, "What happened to the pact? We were both going to change. We shook hands on a pact. Did you not shake my hand on it? You shook my hand. I know you shook my hand." And Jerry says, "You stuck out your hand, so I shook it. So I don't know about a pact. Anyway, you should be happy. You're engaged. You're getting married." And George isn't happy because he thought both he and Jerry were going to be married at the same time, and that's the whole point of the episode, that they were supposed to both get engaged, and George is the only one who went through. So it's that idea of pacts. We all make pacts, right? You might have a pact with your spouse or your children to act a certain way. Like, you may have a pact that once we tuck you in at night, the negotiations are over, right? There's nothing else happening. We're not coming in there. We're not negotiating anymore. You know, we're not doing drinks till midnight. You know, it's done. You're tucked in. That's the pact. There's unspoken pacts as we drive that other drivers will, generally speaking, obey the law, right? Now, for some of us, that means that we want them to actually break the law by going a tad faster. But anyway, we have pacts like that. We have pacts when we purchase things. We have pacts with stores in which we purchase things, that they're going to treat us. Those stores, we have a pact that as long as I'm buying something from you, you're going to treat me a certain way, and also you're going to take care of what I'm purchasing in a certain way, right? That's a pact that we generally have. We have pacts with how we treat one another. We generally treat one another decently. So you might wonder, what's the big deal with all these pacts? Yeah, we don't treat pacts like Jerry and George, and that's a good thing, right? Well, you stuck out your hand and I shook it. I wasn't bound to this. I was just being nice. The biblical word to describe a pact is called covenant. Covenant. You traditionally, biblically speaking, cut a covenant. You didn't make a pact, you cut a covenant. You can see this in the early pages of the Bible. God killed animals, for instance, to cover Adam and Eve in their sin. He put Abraham to sleep, and then he sacrificed animals and laid them out, and God kind of walked down the middle and made a covenant with Abraham. A covenant was cut on Mount Sinai. All the blood was sprinkled on the people, and they said, "Everything that God's spoken, we'll do." God assures us in the prophets that a new covenant would come where his law would be on our hearts. The ways of relating to him would be different. And as Jesus made clear when the cup of the Lord's Supper was described, it pointed to a new covenant in his blood. So there again is the idea of cutting a covenant. So because of Jesus, a way of relating to God would be established forever. And so when we come to 1 Samuel 12, Israel's about to launch into a new chapter. A king had been found for them. So late in chapter 11, we saw last time that Samuel had called the people together at Gilgal to renew the kingdom. Gilgal was significant. When the children of Israel entered the promised land, right before the Jordan River dried up, they had stopped in Gilgal, gathered stones from the Jordan River, and made an altar there. And it was to remind them that God had faithfully brought them through the wilderness. Gilgal was where the nation was circumcised once they entered the promised land. It's the first time they celebrated the Passover together. All this is significant for the people and what they're celebrating. And if you're familiar with covenant language, chapter 12 reads a lot like what we would see if covenant renewal was going to happen in that time period. In other words, the children of Israel have kind of broken a covenant, and now 1 Samuel 12 is that getting patched up, that relationship being renewed. And since Samuel told us that's what he was doing, at the end of chapter 11, where they had gathered together to renew the covenant, renew the kingdom, we know that we're kind of on the right scent if we think that. So in chapter 12, Samuel's going to outline how the covenant had been violated and what needed to happen for it to be restored. So with all that background, we come to this chapter, and I think the encouragement for us today is many of you may enter this room today needing that relationship with God renewed in your own heart. You might say, well, I should be doing that every day. Yeah, sure. But this is where it's happening in our text today. So this is the point of emphasis for us, right? To find some encouragement in renewing our relationship with God. And that's what I hope happens for each of you in this room. That today, that God would just by His Spirit just beckon you back to covenant renewal. A renewal in your relationship with God. A renewal in your walk. So some of us in this room might not have a relationship with God. And you might think, well, this passage, I'm free from responsibility because I don't have a relationship with God. But I think this passage really helps us see some general principles into what relating to God is going to look like. Relating to God is not like Jerry and George, like you stuck your hand out and I shook it. It's not how God is. God's not sticking His hand out and we're just saying, oh yeah, cool, you're God. It's deeper than that. So one writer put it this way. It's only when people see their sin from God's perspective is there hope that they'll turn from that sin. So a general principle here. This is going to loom large in our passage that we've offended God and we can have a relationship with Him renewed. Seeing how you've offended the Holy God of heaven and how you can be drawn into, how your heart can be drawn into a relationship with Him because He's not far. He longs for a relationship with you. I think this passage is calling you to turn and believe and put hope in Him. And maybe you enjoy a relationship with Him. You have a relationship with God and you would say, well, I've done that. You know, I've turned from my sin. Christ is everything to me. Have a relationship with Him. And I think the reality for those of us who've already done that is we can grow stale. Our relationship with God can get real sloppy at times. Maybe unfocused is another word. That we live before Him, but it's just kind of going through the motions. We've lost the focus. It's not doesn't have the clarity. It doesn't have the sharpness that it once had. We've kind of grown stale. It's sloppy. We're living in ways that we know are wrong, but I don't feel like changing that today. And this passage is going to remind us that God is not some domesticated deity that we can trifle with. You can't do that with God. He's holy. So we forget sometimes that because God is so merciful and gracious and forgiving, that He can be offended. And so yes, God is absolutely those things. So today, don't hear me saying that like you're going to get on God's bad list and never be able to get off. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying we forget because God is so gracious and loving and forgiving and gracious towards us. We can forget that we can offend Him. And today is a good reminder of how these people had wronged God. And God still accommodates. He's still gracious. So today, I hope one thing that could happen is in your relationship with God, that you would consider your sin before Him and just return to Him. That there would be renewal in your walk. It could happen as we look at this passage today. So I invite you to join me as we see four aspects of renewing our relationship with God. Four aspects of renewing our relationship with God. And we're going to begin 1 Samuel 12, verses 1 through 15. I'll read that, and then I'll read the rest of the chapters as we come to those passages. But here's how this passage begins. 1 Samuel 12:1. Here's what we read there. And Samuel said to all Israel, "Behold, I've obeyed your voice and all that you've said to me, and have made a king over you. And now, behold, the king walks before you, and I'm old and gray. And behold, my sons are with you. I've walked before you from my youth until this day. Here I am. Testify against me before the Lord and before his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Or whose donkey have I taken? Or whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed? Or from whose hand have I taken a bribe to blind my eyes with it? Testify. Testify against me, and I'll restore it to you. And they said, you've not defrauded us or oppressed us or taken anything from any man's hand. And he said to them, the Lord is witness against you, and his anointed is witness this day that you have not found anything in my hand. And they said, he is witness. And Samuel said to the people, the Lord is witness who appointed Moses and Aaron and brought your fathers up out of the land of Egypt. Now therefore stand still that I may plead with you before the Lord concerning all the righteous deeds of the Lord that he performed for you and for your fathers. When Jacob went into Egypt and the Egyptians oppressed them, then your fathers cried out to the Lord, and the Lord sent Moses and Aaron who brought your fathers out of Egypt and made them dwell in this place. But they forgot the Lord their God, and he sold them into the hands of Sisera, commander of the army of Hazor, and into the hands of the Philistines, and into the hand of the king of Moab, and they fought against them. And they cried out to the Lord and said, we've sinned because we've forsaken the Lord and have served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. But now deliver us from the hand of our enemies that we may serve you. And the Lord sent Jerubbaal and Barak and Jephthah and Samuel and delivered you out of the hand of your enemies on every side, and you lived in safety. And when you saw that Nahash, the king of the Ammonites, came against you, you said to me, no, but a king shall reign over us, when the Lord your God was your king. And now behold the king whom you have chosen, for whom you have asked. Behold, the Lord has set a king over you. If you'll fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice and not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, and if both you and the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God, it will be well. But if you will not obey the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you and your king. This is God's word. Thanks be to God. So four aspects of renewing our relationship with him. And the path to renewal begins with this. We have to understand our sin before God. We have to understand our sin before God. That's really what's going on in these first 15 verses that I just read. Understanding our sin before him. So you might see how this passage flows directly out of chapter 11. In the midst of that kingdom renewal at Gilgal with peace offerings, that's how the chapter ended. Peace offerings and rejoicing happening, that Samuel speaks. And it's almost like he's saying, hey, not so fast. Okay? Yeah. You may think everything's all good in the world, but everything's not all good in the world. You have the earthly king you want, but there's still a party that needs to be witness to these things. Someone that you've offended. And it begins, the passage begins with that, giving us some sense of Samuel's authority, right? Those are those opening verses. Samuel had obeyed Yahweh's instructions from way back in chapter 8 to give the people what they wanted, a king like all the other nations. And now the king was in place. Samuel's old and gray. His sons are before them. We know from this passage that Samuel's sons don't walk in his ways. And so Samuel calls the people to testify against him if he's been unfaithful to his calling. No ox or donkeys have been taken. He's not defrauded, oppressed, or bribed. And the people affirm this, right? That's all that's going on. His integrity in ministry leads to him speaking with authority. So they're witnesses to this. And so in verse 6, Samuel speaks to remind them of God's actions. He says, God's a witness to this. Let's not forget this important party of these proceedings. God, right? God had appointed other leaders for the nation to bring them up out of the land of Egypt. And Samuel's going to plead before the Lord for the people. If Samuel was faithful to the people of Israel, God was immeasurably so. God was way more faithful to the people of Israel than Samuel had ever been. The people's fathers had cried out to the Lord, and he had rescued them from the Egyptians to dwell in the promised land. But the people had forgotten the Lord their God. So God allowed them to go their own way, like with Sisera and the other nations that were raided during the time of the judges. So the people cried out again to God because they had worshipped other gods. And God raised up Jerubbaal, Barak, Jephthah, Samuel to deliver them from their enemies and live in safety. And now we fast forward to the immediate events of chapter 11 when Nahash the Ammonite came a-calling, right? They had asked for a king and God had given them what they wanted, even though, as verse 12 says, God was their king. God was their king. In other words, Samuel's making them known, is God's protection not enough? And are you really going to back out on God? And so verse 14 makes the point clear, right? If you fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice and don't rebel against his commandments, if both you and the king who reigns over you follow the Lord, it'll be well. But if you don't obey and you rebel, then the hand of the Lord will be against you all, both people and king, and all the other people who might speak for the people. So the point is this, God's just reminding them, this king thing can work as long as you endure in your faithfulness to Yahweh. Be devoted to me, God's saying. If you decide to go your own way, trouble's going to come. So the renewal here for these people, they need to come to terms with what was wrong in their actions. What was wrong in asking for a king? They still don't get that. And Samuel's trying to help them see, this was wrong. This wasn't right. You asking for a king when God was your king is not the right thing to do. Samuel still has, he's been relentless on this since chapter 8. I mean, we've hit this theme over and over and over again. And this is kind of the final, the last straw. Like, the people have to come to terms with this. They have to come to terms with what was wrong with their actions. They have to come to terms with how they've sinned against God. And that's where the path to renewal begins for us in this room, right? It's the same for us. We have to come to terms with how we've offended God. We have to come to terms with how we've sinned against him. So we have to have consciences that are tender to God and his word. So think about your life. You know, is your life characterized by tenderness to the things of God? And I realize, you know, that some of you macho men in this room might think that tenderness is not the right word. But one of the fruit of the Spirit is gentleness, okay? So I'm not saying that we just have to be pushovers and cotton balls or whatever. But it is a sign that we're godly when our hearts are tender to God, when we have a listening ear to him, we're open to him. A tenderness to the things of God. Is your heart moldable? Is anybody able to tell you that you're in sin? You might say, well, yeah, I listen to God. Really? I mean, how resistant are you when people are making you aware of these things? Is your heart hard-hearted or is it tender? Is it listening? Is it moldable? Is anyone able to help you see your sin? Or is everybody else always in the wrong? I mean, these are the kind of things that we have to check our hearts on. If it's always somebody else's sin, then you might very well be ignoring some kind of plank in your own eye. So this is where renewal begins. Just searching our hearts. God, is my heart tender before you? I mean, I think it's the great, you know, the cry of the Psalms, right? Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts and see if there's any wicked way within me and lead me into the way everlasting. Are you praying that consistently? Does God have the ability to kind of like drop the scope into your life and see what's going on in your heart? This is where renewal begins. The path to renewal begins by understanding our sin before God. Well, secondly, our passage continues. So we're kind of taking snippets of this, and I know it's kind of clunkily breaking up a narrative that's just flowing here, but seeing our sin before God, that's where it begins. And it continues. Secondly, another aspect of renewing our relationship with God is that often we need to refresh our fear of God. We need to refresh our fear of God. So look with me in verse 16. I'm going to read verses 16 through 19. So Samuel's just kind of laid it all in line here. You obey God, it's going to go well. Go your own way, it's not going to go so well for you or your king. So verse 16, now therefore, stand still and see this great thing that the Lord will do before your eyes. Is it not wheat harvest today? I'll call upon the Lord that he may send thunder and rain, and you will know and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord in asking for yourselves a king. So Samuel called upon the Lord, And the Lord sent thunder and rain that day, and all the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. And all the people said to Samuel, "Pray for your servants to the Lord your God, that we may not die, for we have added to all of our sins this evil, to ask for ourselves a king." So, we need to refresh our fear of God. Samuel gives them some up-close and personal insight into this God that they allegedly serve. There's a great thing that the covenant-keeping Lord would do before them, and it relates to the wheat harvest. The wheat harvest meant typically the rainy season was gone. They wouldn't have usually seen a thunderstorm during the wheat harvest. It was usually pretty dry. And so Samuel said, "I'm going to call upon the Lord." Remember that it reminds us a lot. This whole thing reads kind of like Elijah and the prophets of Baal. Remember where it's dry, or Elijah prays and asks God to raise up a thundercloud, and he saw it at the distance, and then it poured rain, and you know, that's kind of what's going on here. Samuel's going to call upon the Lord. He would send thunder and rain. So this is going to be the second time God's thundered in this book. Thunder! You know, it's going to be great, you know. He's going to thunder. I mean, he thundered upon the Philistines, and they were plundered, and now he's going to thunder upon his people. And the purpose of this thunder, according to Samuel, was that they would awaken the cold hearts of the people. To awaken the cold hearts of the people. By this, they would know and see that their wickedness is great, which they've done in the sight of the Lord, in asking for themselves a king. And so Samuel called upon the Lord, and the Lord delivered a thunderstorm right there. And the result is what? Look at that in verse 19. The people feared. They were begging for mercy. All the people said, "Pray for your servants to the Lord your God, that we may not die, for we've added to all of our sins this evil, to ask for ourselves a king." So they finally get it. It seems like glimmers of repentance are happening here, like the light bulb is coming on. It's flickering at least. Their fear of God needed refreshed, and now God has their attention, right? Samuel's made known, hey, you need to be honest about your sin before the Lord. He's tried to help them see that. And then he's said, "God, come through. Break through the cold hearts. Refresh their fear of you." And that's what happens. I wonder what God has to do to get our attention. We live in a day and age in which everything is meant to be cozy and nice. Any kind of challenge to our comfortable lifestyle can't be from God, because he's a gentleman. He wouldn't bring any difficulty into my life. This is how we tend to think. And if God does bring a difficulty into our life, we think, "God, what are you doing? Do you hate me?" We stubbornly keep going our own way, and we view any threat to us going our own way as not being from God. Now, I'm not suggesting that any kind of difficulty in your life is God trying to get your attention. I'm simply saying, do you even have a category to look to him in a non-questioning way? So your car breaks down and you think immediately, "God, what are you doing? How could you bring this inconvenience into my life? You know I have to go places." And we don't know what God's up to. Like I said last week, that quote from Piper, God may be doing 1,000 things in your life at any moment. We don't know what he's up to. Maybe God just wants you to slow down. Maybe God wants you just to pray to him. Maybe he wants you to seek him. Maybe it's just the car breaking down. Right? But do you have a category for that? That's what I'm asking. Are you seeking him? Are you seeking him in the good times? Are you seeking him when times are not so good? So, I mean, just think about this. The disciples would have never confessed, "Who is this that even the winds and the waves obey him," if they hadn't been with Jesus in the storm? Right? They're never going to reach that conclusion on their own. They have to be in the boat. They have to be experiencing the storm with Jesus asleep at the helm to say, and have Jesus stand up and say, "Hey, chill out," and the storm stopping. They have to be in the storm and experience that for them to see him for who he is. And that's what I'm saying. You have to be in the storm with Jesus. You have to be in this life with God where things don't always go right and this broken world raises its head in your life. to be seeking him, to know that he's there, that he has your full attention always. So seek the Lord. Refresh your fear of him. Awe him. Instead of just saying, why is everybody being so hard on me? You know, or whatever. Just seek him. Refresh your fear of him. God will get your attention. He loves you that way. I mean, that's the point of Hebrews, right? Hebrews 12, that God disciplines those he loves. If there's never anything happening in your life, if God's never getting your attention, does he love you? I mean, this is a sign of his discipline, a sign that he loves us, that he's coming after us, that he's correcting us, that he wants that relationship with us. He wants these people to follow him. He wants it to be the best way possible for them to have a king. But they don't realize that how they've offended him in the midst of that. So he needs to remind them, I'm God of heaven, you're not. He needs to remind them that he's the one to be awed. That they're to have no other gods before him. That they're to love him with all their soul. They have to be reminded of that. Refreshing their fear of him. So our passage continues. It's not over yet, right? So we've seen, got to see our sin, refresh our fear of him. And here's how the passage wraps, beginning in verse 20. And Samuel said to the people, don't be afraid. You've done all this evil, yet don't turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. Don't turn aside for empty things that can't profit or deliver, for they're empty. For the Lord will not forsake his people for his great name's sake, because it pleased the Lord to make you a people for himself. Moreover, as for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you, and I'll instruct you in the good and the right way. Only fear the Lord and serve him faithfully with all your heart. For consider what great things he has done for you. But if you still do wickedly, you will be swept away, both you and your king. So Samuel again speaks to the people. And by the way, I think those are some structural notes, right? He's established his credentials and spoken, beginning in verse 1. He's laid out God's case to these people and called them to repent, beginning in verse 6. And now he gives them reminders that are informed by grace. So we fall into the grace extended to us. That's the point. We fall into the grace that's extended to us. Grace. So he gives them reminders that are informed by grace, beginning here in verse 20, by speaking to them. They seem terrified in their hearts, but Samuel's first word to them is, don't be afraid. Yes, you are evil people. And we know that you're evil people because you've done evil things. But don't turn from following the Lord and serve the Lord with all your heart. So that's the point, right? They're to be undivided in their affections. They're undivided. So like, don't be divided. Like, don't like serve the Lord and then like serve the world another day or serve yourselves another day, right? It's all kind of putting these things at odds. You've done all this evil, yes, yet don't turn aside from following the Lord and serve the Lord with all your heart. You know, remain focused in this. Don't have an undivided heart with divided affections. Or don't have a divided heart with divided affections. Have an undivided heart with undivided affections rooted solely in God. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and serve him accordingly is kind of another way you could word it. There, look at the command of verse 21. Do not turn aside after empty things that cannot profit or deliver, for they are empty. Right? Get it? Are you hearing the point there? That's our big temptation, by the way. Rather than running to God when the heat gets turned up in our lives, when God's trying to get our attention, we run to other things that aren't going to satisfy. We run to buy things to cover up our boredom. We run to pornography rather than intimacy with our spouses. We go after substance abuse that might cause addiction rather than receiving refreshment that God offers through fellowship with him and others. We run after all these things and we do it consistently. We binge on Netflix because, you know, we just need to refresh. And is that really going to restore our souls? No, I'm not saying you can't enjoy any of these things, right? Well, pornography, I'm not saying you can enjoy that. But, I mean, there's all kinds of things that God's, good things that God's given us to enjoy in this world. But our tendency is to abuse them, right? Our tendency is not like, oh, a little enjoyment, this is great. Our tendency is, oh, this is so good, I think I'm going to die on this, right? Oh, this chocolate cake is so fantastic, I think I'll eat the whole thing for myself. That's how we tend to go. And the reminder of verse 21, we need that emblazoned on our eyelids, right? Do not turn aside after empty things that cannot profit or deliver, for they are empty. I mean, it's like, how many times can he say they're no good for us? Empty things, they don't profit, they don't deliver, they're empty. Right? Get it? That's the point. Don't turn aside after those things. Don't run after things that can't profit or deliver. They are empty. It's an amazing confession. But here's the deal. I mean, look at, after saying that, you may say, well, who can live this way? And then he tells us that God's not going to forsake us for his great name's sake. In other words, like even probably when we go after those things and fail, verse 22 is saying, for the Lord will not forsake his people. He is doggedly determined to come after us. And he's not doggedly determined to us because of who we are. Why is he going to do that in verse 22? The Lord will not forsake his people for his great name's sake, because it's pleased the Lord to make you a people for himself. In other words, God has a higher glory than you being you. God has a higher glory than just you and him getting to hang out at the end of the day. And God's higher glory is because of his namesake. And because it pleased him to make you a people for himself. That's what's driving him. That's why he's never going to give up on you. That's why he's going to follow you to the ends of the earth to get your attention. Because he loves you. You're his people. He's the Lord. He is the covenant-keeping God of Israel. Look at all these times in this passage where Lord is there in all cap letters, right? When we see the Lord in the Old Testament text in all cap letters, it's referring to Yahweh. It's referring to the covenant-keeping God of Israel. And what is emphatic here is God is not going to give up on that. We may abandon the covenant. We may want another king. We may think that God's not enough. But God's never going to give up on that because he is a covenant-keeping God. To the ends of the earth, he's going to do that. Never going to give up on us. Samuel says, you know, I'm going to stay devoted, I'm going to pray for you. And then he comes back, verses 24 and 25, again reminding them, fear the Lord, serve him faithfully with all your heart. So our motivation is to be like what motivates God, right? Because we're his people, and because he's so devoted to us, what are we going to do? Like serve ourselves? No. Samuel's saying in verse 24, so serve him, fear him with all your heart, serve him faithfully. Consider what great things the Lord has done for you. That's the motivator for our lives. That's power to get us through another week. That's power to wake us up on Monday morning and give us something to live for. Look at the amazing things that God's done for you. And he's not given up on you yet. I mean, after all these people, God had rescued them out of the land of Egypt. And God's saying, I'm not giving up on you yet, even though you came back and worshipped other gods. I mean, just think about the golden calf. God brings them out of Egypt with plagues through the Red Sea. They arrive. They promise everything God says will do. And they make a golden calf and say, this is the God who brought you out of Egypt. And God still had mercy on them. God still got them to the promised land. That nation he did. I mean, there was a punishment for that generation, right? They died in the wilderness. And that's all that Samuel's saying here. Fear the Lord, serve him faithfully with all your heart. Don't forget the great things he's done for you. If you forget these great things, makes us run after those empty things. But there's a warning here at the end. If you're going to choose to do wickedly, then you're going to be swept away, you and whatever king you choose. But God's the one who makes the difference. God's the one who makes the difference. He's the one who never gives up on you. He's the one who's going to never forsake you. He's the one who's going to doggedly run after you, no matter where you go. So look at the amazing grace that God has extended in showing us what it looks like to follow him. We serve him faithfully and wholeheartedly by remembering what great things he's done for us, not turning from him to empty, worthless things. And by remembering the love that he has for us isn't based on our performance. His love for us is based on his own standards of covenant-keeping faithfulness. This is incredible. Even when we're faithless, he remains faithful. but we shouldn't pursue wickedness. That's kind of how Samuel's doing it, right? All this great thing that God's done, all this power plant we have that should motivate our affections and drive us to live a certain way, but don't go after wickedness, lest we be swept away. So renewal comes as we rest in the grace that he's extended to us. And I think there's a point here in my fourth and final point that renewal comes as we realize who is for us. We realize who is for us. In verse 23, this was Samuel speaking, right? He said, "Moreover, as for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you, and I will instruct you in the good and the right way." So I mentioned Samuel's faithfulness in passing, and I think it's a rich application for us. Samuel wouldn't sin against the Lord by failing to pray for people and instructing them in the right way. Romans 5:20, we know this is how God operates, right? Romans 5:20, that when it comes to God, where sin abounds, what does grace do in the life of a believer? Grace superabounds. So where sin is pronounced, grace is more pronounced, right? That's Romans 5:20. Where sin abounds, grace abounds all the more. And there's grace for us in a verse like for Samuel 12:23, as Samuel points us to the one in whom we have confidence. We have one who's for us as well. And who is that one? In showing us how Christ is a priest in the order of Melchizedek, the writer of Hebrews says in Hebrews 7:25, "Consequently, he is able, that is, Jesus is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for us." Always lives. I mean, Jesus is the better Samuel. Samuel's not going to fail these people. He says, "I'm going to keep praying for you. I'm going to keep instructing you in the right way." And when we hear Samuel say that, we ought to be thinking, "Ah, we got one for us as well. We got one for us who, at God's right hand, will never cease to pray for us, never cease to intercede for us." And consequently, because he's there doing that, we have every reason to believe that grace will succeed in our hearts as we seek to live for God. We're not going to be abandoned. So, I mean, what encouragement we have that Jesus Christ the Lord lives to make intercession for us. That's why his resurrection is going to be so huge, right? We're getting ready to celebrate in 2 weeks this resurrection. I mean, we celebrate in a sense every week as we gather together, but 2 weeks when we're focused in on Easter, and that's what his resurrection means. That he's alive right now making intercession for us. So renewal is inspired by realizing who is for you. So this is our how this all laid out today. In conclusion, we've seen four aspects of renewing our relationship with God. We have to understand our sin before God. We need to refresh our fear of God. We fall into the grace that's extended to us. And we realize who is for us. So I said in the introduction that it's only when people see their sin from God's perspective that there's hope that they'll turn from it. And I hope that's what's happened for you today. You've sinned and fallen short of God's glory. You don't live up to his standards. But there's hope because he's extended grace to sinners like us. Jesus came that we might be set free from sin and made alive to righteousness, that we would live for that. So we don't have to wallow in our inability to live right. I mean, I think that happens at times, like, "Oh, I just can't do this. This Christian life is so difficult." We don't have to wallow in that inability. We can be saved by grace through faith in Jesus Christ and have that power plant of factory driving our affections changed by the life-giving power of the Holy Spirit pumping grace through our veins every day of our lives. Thinking about all the great things that God's done for us and being able to live for righteousness' sake. That's what it means to be a Christian. Not that we're perfect, but that we're so redeemed and we so operate out of grace every moment of our lives that what else could we do but live? So today, will you turn from sin and believe in him? Will you put all your confidence in him? Trust in Jesus and know the salvation that he gives? And the reality of our sin before God leads us to live. So fear the Lord. Does your reverence of God lead you to serve him? Are you following him wholeheartedly? Maybe you look at your life right now and you say, God, I've turned aside after empty things that can't profit or deliver, and they're empty. I mean, you know that. You know what it is in your life, and it's an empty thing. So, what do we do? I think probably in this room, this last bit, fearing the Lord, does your reverence lead you to serve him? Yeah. Are you following him wholeheartedly? Yeah. Are you turning aside after empty things that can't profit or deliver? Well, not really. I mean, there's probably some people in the room for whom that's the case. But is that really what God thinks? I mean, if he thundered in here today, would you really be saying, yeah, I serve you wholeheartedly? Yeah, I'm following you. Wherever you go, I'm living that out. There's no empty things that I'm pursuing in my life. Would you really say that to him? I mean, I think every single one of us as individuals, we know that there's somebody like ahead of us, like, oh man, like they're a super Christian. But most of us think, I'm a pretty decent Christian. I do a pretty good job with this. And is that true? Might God have put a passage like 1 Samuel 12 in the Bible just to get our attention? To say, you're not the big shot of the world. I am. I am. That's what God's wanting us to know. And the reason I know that is, who are the people in this room stepping out of inconvenience to follow the Lord wholeheartedly? Who are the people consistently saying no to being inconvenienced? Following the Lord with all your heart. Not just a part of it, but all of it. So, I'm pressing that point because I think that's the heart of what Samuel's after here. These people are looking for wiggle room. They've gone their own way. They don't want a king. They don't want God to be their king. They want a king like all the other nations. And God's saying, okay, there's a way this can work. You're my people. I'm devoted to you. Nothing pleases me more than you being my possession. But serve me. I want your whole heart. I don't want you going after all this other stuff. And so today in this room, God, that same reminder needs to go off in your soul. God's wanting to renew the covenant. He's wanting to renew that relationship. And say, man, there's a way you can live in this world. There's a way you can do that. You're not going to bat 1,000. There's a way you can live in this world. So serve me wholeheartedly. Don't get wrapped up in all these other rogue affections. Serve me. I want your whole heart. You want to go down the path of wickedness, you're going to be swept away. And you and whatever thing you put in place of me. But seek me. Serve me. So, today, let's step into the grace. The grace of a God who delights in us, his people, and who's done great things for us. Let's renew our walk with him, that we may glorify and enjoy him forever.